Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. We've discussed colon cancer many times before, but it's been really quite a while since we've really looked at it from a surgeon's point of view. And on this program, Anchorage colorectal surgeons Dr. Carrie Bossard and Dr. Dan Rossi will discuss colon cancer and the role of surgeons in this disorder. And as time permits, we'll talk about other colorectal diseases as well. Dr. Bossard is it Bossard?
Bossard.
I am sorry.
That's
Dr.
okay.
Dr. Bossard went to medical school in Georgia and did most of her training there in general surgery, and then did a colorectal fellowship at Creighton University in Omaha. Dr. Rossi got his DO degree in West Virginia, did all of his training there, and then his colorectal residency at Swedish in Seattle, Washington. Both joined the Alaska Colorectal Surgery Organization here in 2014. It's a pleasure to have both of you. Thanks for taking the time to come in today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Dr. Bossard and Dr. Rossi, take a second and maybe tell us a little bit about the training of surgeons, if you don't mind. I suspect people don't understand the time it takes. And then why a subspecialty in fellowship in colorectal? And then what do colorectal surgeons end up doing most of the time?
So training for a surgeon starts with medical school for 4 years, and then the residency for surgery is anywhere from 5 to 7 years, depending on the program. Beyond that, fellowships, in addition, can be anywhere from 1 to 2 years. The training varies based on research time and other variables in the programs, but that's a pretty broad outline of what the training would entail. Why choose colorectal surgery? I get that question commonly. Right. People want to know, why would I want to specialize in this area? I have a unique perspective. I did practice general surgery for 7 years. And during that time, I saw a lot of patients who came in that had colorectal complaints, and they were really embarrassed or shy to talk about those complaints. They really just felt like they were the only person in the world who would have that issue. And after talking to hundreds of patients about these incidents and these problems they were having, an opportunity came up for me to go back and do fellowship training. And I always had a passion for colorectal, but it was just the right time. So for me, it was just seeing patients having concerns and having complaints and just not really feeling comfortable speaking with their providers about it. And for me, that was what determined going back.
So what was it about the disorders that was so made you have a passion? Is it the kind of surgery you're doing, the difficulty patients had talking about it? Or all of the above?
It's a little bit of both. The colorectal surgery is rather complex and rather nuanced in many ways. It's not always just straightforward as it is in some other surgical issues at times. And so the fact that patients would, you know, I had a patient who'd had a problem for 21 years and we fixed it with a simple surgery and mm-hmm. he was just the happiest person. Right. So just to see that the patients finally would be able to talk about it, there was something we could do to fix it. And then the surgery is challenging and rewarding at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Rossi, what's your story?
I would second that. I think, from my perspective, I did my fellowship training for colorectal, immediately after completing my general surgery. And along the line, I preferred a little more focused practice. So rather than doing everything from, say, thyroid surgery to breast surgery to possibly some colon surgery in one day, I preferred a little more specialized practice. And then also within the colorectal field, I found that provided variety, as we deal with anything from hemorrhoids to complex laparoscopic and robotic surgery for colon and rectal cancers. And one of the primary motivating force for me was the relationship that you're able to develop with the cancer patients, especially.
Mm-hmm. When I was in training in the 70s, and I don't remember colorectal cancer being especially, and it may be because I was not a surgeon. Everybody was kind of a general surgeon or a neurosurgeon or an orthopedic surgeon. When did at least the colorectal group separate, and what factors were driving that?
as a society from the 50s, and it was referred to as proctology.
Ah.
And so a lot of times people will ask you, are you a proctologist?
Right.
And,
right.
You know, the society then developed a separate licensing board, and also in that process changed the name to colon and rectal surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the, even to this date, one of the few specialty practices within surgery that has a separate licensing board. So in you know, not only are we board certified in general surgery, but also in colorectal surgery as well.
I like to think of what's going on in medicine is similar to what's going on in aviation. Maybe you can fly a plane, that's one thing, but flying a Boeing 777 may be different than flying a fighter plane. And the amount of knowledge that we are accumulating about things is driving people into more and more subspecialization. And I guess from a surgical standpoint, it must be that we get better and better. We have less complications, less problems if we're doing the same, particularly more difficult or not so common surgeries over and over and over again. And that must be part of what's driving this.
Yeah, I think for colon and rectal surgery, in our fellowship training, we do a lot of work deep in the pelvis, so doing a lot of rectal cancer. And then the other thing that we do that I think that we have a lot of additional training in is just some of the decision-making around anorectal surgery, which can be very complex and difficult at times. And so that additional training with the anorectal surgery and deep in the pelvis doing rectal cancer and other mm-hmm. rectal procedures, I think, is part of what we get doing a fellowship that's a little bit different.
I have failed to let everyone know who's listening how they can get a hold of us today. I want to remind everybody you're listening to Line One, your health connection. We're talking about colorectal cancer with colorectal surgeons Dr. Kerry Bossard and Dr. Dan Rossi. And if you have questions, particularly about colorectal cancer, but other colorectal disorders that may fall into their expertise, don't hesitate to give us a call. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. The toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Bossard, I think this decision-making thing is an issue that I want to get into a little bit later, but it's an important part of surgery is that the public probably doesn't think about as much. And I have a good story that'll lead us into it, but I'm gonna come back to that a little bit later. And I want to ask you guys, what's your day like right now? What's the typical day? How many days a week are you doing surgery? What are the kind of patients you're seeing?
Well, you know, I think I speak for both of us here, but I would say during a week, the surgical practice, you know, or our days in surgery are anywhere from about 2 to 3 days per week on average. And the remainder of that week is filled with, you know, seeing patients in the clinic. And, you know, those procedures can vary anywhere from day surgeries, you know, for fistulas, hemorrhoid procedures, to endoscopy, colonoscopy, I should say, and then on a surgical day, those procedures can become more complex when we're operating for colon and rectal cancers. So that's kind of sums up, you know, the routine week.
Okay, so most of your surgery is colorectal surgery or cancer surgery.
I would say it's a good mix.
Okay.
I would say, you know, probably about 60-40, 50-50, somewhere in that ballpark.
Okay.
And that, again, from, you know, in terms of benign versus a malignant disease.
Okay. Carry the same thing?
Yeah, I would agree. We do spend about 2 to 3 days a week in surgery, and we may have a day where we do more major cases, big cancer resections, and then doing anorectal procedures for a day and doing colonoscopies as well. So it is varied. We also take call, and so that sometimes will change our surgical load as well. But
one of the things that I've been doing this long enough, been in practice up here since about 1980, that things have changed in medicine, and not just the way we practice medicine, but the kinds of disorders we see. And in pediatrics, I used to see a couple of cases of meningitis a year. I haven't seen a case in 15 years, and that's clearly because of immunizations. The kinds of disorders that we see, it's not so much acute care anymore. It's much more chronic problems and a lot of parenting, psychosocial kinds of issues. Has the practice of colorectal cancer changed considerably? Have you seen new and different things you didn't used to see? Or maybe you guys haven't been at this long enough to notice that. But are there changes? I know there's changes in how you practice and what you're doing in surgery, but I'm thinking about more in the disorders. Not any big change.
I'm not sure that there are any large changes. I mean, we were talking that there has been a slow decrease in the incidence of colon and rectal cancer in the United States.
Right.
But as far as other disorders, you know, there's some new medical treatments that we've been using for inflammatory bowel disease. It's really kind of changed the game there.
Right.
But for other colon and rectal cancer treatment, I think it's the chemotherapy agents. But from a surgical standpoint, we have new technology as well.
And the only interesting trend that that I've seen in my limited amount of practice over the past 4 to 5 years, though, and some of the data out there is that even though we're seeing some decreasing trends, we're seeing an increase in a younger population, and I find interesting. And I'm not sure if I don't think anyone knows quite at this time what's driving that. If it's just a result of earlier screening, people being more aware, but that's an interesting trend.
And you're talking about colorectal cancer in particular, we're seeing younger individuals.
We are, yes,
it's different.
Yeah.
Yeah, Crohn's disease, the inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, regional enteritis, seem to be more common, but what you're saying is now there's more medical approaches leading to less surgical intervention because complications are being held down or the control of the disorder is a little bit better.
Yes, I would agree with that, certainly.
All right, so let's talk about colorectal cancer. It's a huge part of what you're practicing every day. It's a huge part of what oncologists are doing every day. Put some face on colorectal cancer for us. What's going on there? What's the causes? You've already alluded to the fact that we know the incidence seems to be slowly in decreasing, at least over the last 10 years or so, about 3% per year, which is really pretty good. So tell us some more about colorectal cancer.
So I would say what we do know is that about 90% of colorectal cancer that we see is in patients over the age of 50. Things that can increase risk for development of colorectal cancer would be things like smoking, obesity. There are some family and genetic components to colorectal cancer, but that really is a small subset of patients. So we do see some risks that we know that we could improve upon if we could do patient education and get patients to make some small changes in their daily lives. But I would say those would be a couple of the items.
What the incidence we've discussed is coming down a little bit, and it's not clear why that is, at least to me. And you mentioned smoking as a risk factor. I always wonder. I know a lot of cancers have decreased and were related to it. Are there other possible reasons for the decline in the new cases of colorectal cancer, even though we've also alluded to the fact that sometimes we're seeing it in younger populations? Any ideas?
You know, we don't have any definitive evidence on that. I personally do believe that with improved education, access to health care, and in earlier screening, that does aid in decreasing the cancer rates that we're seeing, simply because a large proportion of colon and rectal cancers develop from colon polyps. And so if we're able to remove those polyps before they've had time to develop into a cancer, you're going to decrease those rates of cancer development. I think that may also at the same time have an impact as to why we're sometimes seeing a rise in cancers in younger individuals, because that's being caught earlier. They may have some bleeding, and it's a cancer that's found, but possibly at an earlier stage.
Let me remind listeners once again, we're talking to Dr. Dan Rossi and Dr. Carrie Bossard, colorectal surgeons. We're talking primarily about colorectal cancer, and if you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433, our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. my looking at the data is the incidence, those new cases of colorectal cancer are decreasing. The mortality rate, that is people who are dying from colorectal cancer, is also decreasing, but not at quite the same rate. And why might that be?
I think even with excellent care, we still have a small subset of patients who are diagnosed at a more advanced stage. Mm-hmm. And so even though we're doing a good job with screening, we're getting those polyps out before they have a chance to turn into cancer, there's still a small subset of patients who come in with advanced stage disease. And I think that likely contributes to the slowing of the mortality rate, but not at the same degree of the incidence.
You mentioned, Dr. Rossi, that there is a natural history of this particular kind of cancer, colorectal cancer, and the development of a polyp beforehand, which is kind of a sentinel, a lesion that might be recognized and lead to earlier detection. Can you tell us what's the time sequence of this? We've talked about cancers on the program quite a bit, and we're learning that most cancers have a long life before they really come to some significance. It is a general rule. So what's the time sequence of this disorder? And
sure. Yeah, for the average individual.
Okay.
Meaning that there is no family history or they haven't had any other, diagnosis of polyps at a previous time. The average time is about a 10-year process to start from development of that polyp to development or to progression to a cancer. And that's why the task force and multidisciplinary societies or groups, when they've looked at this, have recommended a screening and then a 10-year surveillance interval before you repeat that colonoscopy. And again, that's in the average individual.
Mm-hmm. 10 years from the onset or the discovery of the polyp towards the likelihood of that becoming a cancer?
10 years from when a polyp begins to form.
Uh-huh.
And then before it transgresses to becoming a cancer.
Okay. What percentage of polyps do we know the answer that becomes? So just because you have a polyp, does that mean it's going to become cancer in a person's lifetime? You have to put some time sequence on this.
Sure. And it depends on the type of polyp.
Okay.
So the primary type of polyp is what's referred to as an adenoma. And then within that, there are three different subsets. So you have a tubular villus, and a villus. And so the villus is on the more aggressive end of the spectrum, and a tubular has less risk. And so for a tubular adenoma, your risk is roughly about 5 to 10%, depending on what literature you read. For a tubular villus, about 15%, and then upwards to about 20, 25% roughly for a villus in terms of developing into a cancer.
So the microscopic anatomy of a polyp, once it's removed, does also imply some aggressiveness, which is another thing that we're learning about cancers is on this program in particular, is that just because you have a breast cancer doesn't mean that's the same as all breast cancers, and that's true of prostate cancer.
Absolutely, and there are certain types of polyps, because a lot of times patients will say, I had a polyp, and they didn't tell me to do anything differently.
Right.
My surveillance interval did not change for when I needed to have that next colonoscopy. And that's because there are certain types of polyps that have a very small chance of developing into that or almost none at all. And so that microscopic identification definitely has or subset definitely has an influence.
Heather, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Thank you. I'm concerned about the cost of colonoscopy. I've been talking to both some doctors and some insurance companies. Insurance companies, for example, are sending colonoscopies down to Seattle, Swedish, or Virginia Mason, and they can pay airfare for both the patient and a friend to go along, a spouse to go along, pay for a couple of nights in a hotel, and get the colonoscopy done and bring them home, and they are still half the price that they are here in Anchorage. Why is that?
I think that's a great question. I think that the medical climate in Alaska in general is much different. I think that it's because we're so remote for a long time. I think it was rather difficult to have physicians be willing to come to Alaska to practice. If you were from here, that would be something that you'd be more comfortable doing. So I think, you know, Dan and I are relatively new here. It is a new climate and a different climate. And I think that's the way that part of why the costs are more is originally availability of resources to be here as far as providers. You know, the insurance companies and facilities, I can't really speak a lot to that. But I know it's definitely a different practice climate here than it is in the lower 48. And I think part of that is the remoteness and the availability of resources.
Does that mean that possibly the price might come down, that doctors might not charge as much in the future?
Well, you know, a lot of times this doesn't, it's not influenced by the physician charge or the facility charge. It a lot of times has to do with insurance and negotiations that have been made there. And so that is always something that is fluid and can change from time to time. You know, does that answer your question?
It does, and I guess the one other issue that came up in cost is that the facility itself is, well, at least in two cases that I'm aware of, the facility is owned by the physicians, and it's disclosed that it's a potential conflict of interest, but it's still, you know, it's an issue that's there.
Sure, yeah, and on that point, you know, I don't have any ownership in that, so I can't speak, you know, in an educated manner on that topic. But I do understand your point. The only thing that I think sometimes gets lost on this conversation is that yes, you can go out of state and cost, but if there are any type of complications or issues, then you sometimes have difficulty with that follow up. And I think that's an important point for patients to understand, because unfortunately, in healthcare, that does happen and can become an issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you for the information.
Sure. My pleasure.
Let's take another caller. John, you're on line one.
Yes. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I'm a young 71-year-old guy. I get a PSA test every couple of years, but ongoing, I have experienced a rectal pain, usually late at night, and just totally overpowering. But I've read a lot on it, and I take a couple antihistamines, and poof, it's gone. Could you comment on that, and I'll hang up and let you go for it.
Don't leave too quick here. Antihistamines is what you take, and it seems to be correlated with improvement in your symptoms.
Absolutely. It just, okay. I mean, I take a couple antihistamines, mm-hmm. and within a, two or three minutes, it's gone. Mm. It used to just double me over, and boy, yeah. I was just, it was terrible.
What's the antihistamine you take?
Oh, boy, I can't tell you that at the present time.
That's all right. All right. Do you have other symptoms other than pain? Diarrhea? Do you attribute your pain to anything you're eating? Any other hints here?
No, not at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most weird thing I've ever experienced, and I got into some of my wife's health digests, and it brought that up, and I thought, holy mackerel, this works.
Okay.
It's golden.
Yep. I am not a colorectal person, but I think of possibly antihistamines helping if there was some allergic phenomenon. In pediatrics, we definitely see an allergic proctocolitis, usually associated with bleeding, but it's usually painless. We see it very commonly in breastfed babies associated, it appears, with milk and soy. And I am not trying to lead you in that direction. I'm just trying to say, wow, this is different to me. So let me ask the colorectal surgeons their experience.
You know, one question I would have here is, you say you take the antihistamine at night when this occurs. Do you feel more, does it make you more tired or more relaxed after taking that antihistamine?
Not particularly.
Don't notice
at
anything
all.
There.
Other than I can get back to sleep. I mean, this thing will, it'll make me stand up and take notice in a heartbeat.
Anorectal pain is a very complex problem, and we see a lot of patients with a lot of different causes for anorectal pain. Often a thorough examination, we can sometimes get to the bottom of it. We do have some patients who it can be a vexing problem. I'm just really happy for you that the antihistamine helps, because it can be a very debilitating problem. We have patients that we see in our practice that really it affects their ability to get through their daily activity. So I don't have a great answer for why the antihistamine is relieving your rectal pain, but I'm glad that you found a simple solution.
And I would just follow that up with it to have pain like that that's waking you up is not normal. And so that is something that I would recommend having someone evaluate that, just to make sure that there's nothing underlying that could be more problematic and that you're masking. And so to have that type of symptom is, I just wanted to impress upon you the need to at least have someone at least evaluate if it's not resolving.
It's happened a lot less, and it could be stress related. I've been in business for myself for many, many years, and
right.
I think I've got a little bit more handle on it today than I used to. So at least I'd like to believe that.
Yeah. What I think I'm hearing here is, and to give you my best advice, you got two experts who spend a lot of time on this. This is an unusual, not an uncommon problem with an unusual apparent association. So I'd be a little careful about the association, and especially if symptoms are getting worse over time, have somebody talk to somebody else about this. Yeah.
Yeah, they're actually getting better. That's why suggesting maybe stress
Good.
Related.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, they do control histamines. I can theorize all kinds of possible, but it's unusual coincidence of symptom relief with that kind of medication. Incidentally, Zyrtec and Claritin, those kind of antihistamines really don't get into the blood-brain barrier, across the blood-brain barrier, so they probably wouldn't relax you like Benadryl or one of the over-the-counter things also, although that certainly is a possibility too for stress.
Benadryl, it probably is Benadryl, because I'm also allergic to bee stings, and that I keep that stuff around.
Okay. Oh. You've ever had food allergies?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay, I don't want to beat that. Everything gets blamed on allergy, and a lot of times it's not, so forget that one. But anyway, good
Thanks
luck with
lot.
That. Okay.
Hey, and don't laugh when I say 71, because I still feel reasonably young.
Well,
you're my hero.
You're the one guy in here today that's a little older than me, so I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take one more. I've got an email here before we take our break, and this is, could you discuss the long-term effects of colectomy? So my mother was dealing with ulcerative colitis for about 15 years, the writer says. Her current flare-up has been going on for over a year and is quite debilitating. There are a few medical options, let's say, related to her, and the doctor is saying she thinks that she'd benefit from having her colon removed. I'm wondering how this will affect her life and long-term effects. So this gets into that decision-making process. We don't know how old this lady is, which is a very important factor, I think,
Absolutely.
To put into this equation. But let's assume she is, I don't know. Boy, I don't know about Crohn's disease and the elderly. I'm thinking she has to be 60 or older, but let's say she's over 50.
In terms of function, if I'm understanding this question correctly, in terms of function and what to expect after surgery, depending on the type of inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, the management can change in terms of what is resected. But when you have a significant amount of the colon removed, things that you can expect are going to be range from increased frequency to urgency, and even change in consistency of bowel movements. And now that is something that medically we can try work on to improve if you are having some type of sequela from that. But I counsel all of my patients that they may notice some change in their bowel function following surgery, for those type of diseases or any type of colectomy for that matter.
And I think the concern with the question, and again, we don't have a lot of details, but with ulcerative colitis, there is an increased risk of colorectal cancer. I'm sure that the patient, the person who sent the email, their mother's been undergoing screening. It sounds like she's well plugged into the medical establishment, but that would be something to consider in that case, particularly that if she does have extensive disease extending throughout her entire colon, that would increase her risk pretty substantially of colorectal cancer. And at some point it becomes an evaluation of risk and benefit ratio of how much time goes by before we talk about getting surgery. For patients with ulcerative colitis, it can be very debilitating to the point that they just can't leave their house anymore. And we see a lot of those patients who are just really fearful of having surgery. And when they finally go through with it, they are usually very, very glad that they finally chose to do it because it gives them their life back.
Yep. So the response to surgery for Crohn's disease or some of these inflammatory is usually pretty good. So the quality of life improves, although there may be some disadvantages, as we've discussed.
Usually, when a patient has reached the point that they need surgery for these diseases, they have what we refer to as they've maximized their medical management. And the surgery becomes kind of the last resort in those situations. And a lot of time the colon is so diseased at that point and the function is so poor that once we actually remove it, they actually experience an improvement in the quality of life because, this poor colon function has not only had an effect on their bowel function but also just on their body in general, and so in terms of nutrition and things like that. And so a lot of times patients with these diseases actually do feel better and are improved after the surgery.
Once you have portions of your colon removed, colostomy is another thought that people may have. And might explain what colostomy is and when is the colostomy necessary now?
So colostomies or ileostomies, the colostomy refers to the colon and the ileostomy refers to the small bowel, is where we bring a segment of bowel out through the abdominal wall. And the material that comes through the colon or the small intestine is then emptied into a bag that's placed on the abdominal wall. We have multiple reasons at times to use colostomies and ileostomies. As colorectal surgeons, our goal is to always try to put the bowel back together. And we usually use those colostomies and ileostomies as a last resort only. A case where a colostomy might be indicated is someone who had a cancer low in the rectum that involves the muscles at the bottom that control your ability to control your bowel movements. And in those cases, we just don't really have an option other than taking out the bottom, the rectum, and the anal area along with the sphincter muscles and bringing up a colostomy. Sometimes we use ileostomies or colostomies as a temporary means to get things in the pelvis to heal or to help the patient kind of get over a rough patch, improve their nutrition, multiple reasons that we'll do a temporary ileostomy or colostomy and then go back later and reattach that bowel so things go through and flow like they previously did.
So it sounds like to me, again, as somewhat of a naive just person listening to this, that the colostomies are not as common as they used to be. We have abilities to get around the need for them to the extent that we used to.
Absolutely. The technologies have improved in terms of the instruments that we're able to use with the use of laparoscopic surgery and robotic surgery. It allows us to complete a good dissection much lower into the pelvis. And that's really where things become more technically difficult. As colorectal surgeons, I think one of our big focuses is what's referred to, and patients may see this when they're, if they're looking on the internet, is sphincter preservation.
Uh-huh.
And that means basically being able to dissect as low as we can and be able to reconnect things without a permanent colostomy.
Okay. We need to take a break. I want to remind listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number again is 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and continue our discussion with colorectal surgeons Dr. Kerry Bossard and Dr. Dan Rossi. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage and Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, our guests are Anchorage colorectal surgeons Dr. Carrie Bossard and Dr. Dan Rossi. We're discussing primarily colorectal cancer, and from the surgeon's point of view, if we have time, we'll talk about other colorectal diseases, but certainly feel free to email or call if you have questions about colorectal disorders that you think is appropriate for us to discuss. Our local number, 550-8433, toll free, 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening between 9 and 10 p.m. on a Monday evening, it's a taped rebroadcast. We will not be able to answer your questions at that time. We have not discussed the symptoms of colorectal cancer. I think we need to do that. And then maybe briefly discuss some recommendations, if you don't mind, before we move on to some other issues.
So in terms of signs or symptoms of colon cancer, you know, some of the most common include anal bleeding, anal rectal bleeding, abdominal pain, change in your bowel function. So if, you know, to just chalk, you know, chronic diarrhea or chronic constipation or straining, those type of issues, you know, those are things that should not be written off as just something you're eating or routine occurrences. Those should be followed up with evaluation. Unexpected weight loss, can be another sign to tip you off in terms of malignancy. I think those are some of the primary signs or symptoms that you should be focusing on.
The other thing that I always tell patients that's important for screening is that we have a subset of patients who have absolutely no symptoms, and they come in for their colonoscopy when they're 50 years old and there's a cancer. And so I think it's really important to just talk about keeping up on screening. Recommendations are that you start at age 50 with a colonoscopy. There are some alternate recommendations as well, fecal blood testing in your physician's office every year. Or what's called a flexible sigmoidoscopy. That's a little bit less invasive endoscopy procedure where the physician passes the scope up only halfway through the colon. Or you can do what's called a barium enema, which is a radiographic test where you go to the radiology department and have contrast placed in the colon to look for signs of change there, and that's recommended every 5 years. If you were to have a fecal occult blood test that was positive, or a flexible sigmoidoscopy that showed polyps, or a barium enema that was positive, the standard would then be to go on to do a colonoscopy. There is some discussion about doing CT colonography. Patients like to ask about that. Can I just get a CAT scan and not have to go through all of this? What I always tell patients some of the drawbacks of that test are is you still have to do the bowel prep. We do put a catheter into your rectum in order to instill the contrast, and you're wide awake. So a lot of patients will then say, well, I'd rather have some sedation and have my colonoscopy. Any of those lesser tests, if you do have anything that's concerning there, it needs to be followed up with a colonoscopy, and that's really the gold standard. For patients who have a family history in their mother or father or sister or brother or daughter or son, we would recommend screening at a younger age, starting at age 40. Or if there is a history of significant polyps in one of those what are called first-degree relatives, we'd recommend screening at a younger age as well, usually at age 40, but it would depend on the patient and the situation.
Looking at the national statistics that are in front of me, the median age of diagnosis of colorectal cancer is 68, given that polyps have probably been present at least 10 years and some polyps bleed, and that my understanding is in that age group, someone's coming in with anemia and maybe unsuspected bleeding. They may not realize they're bleeding. It could be microscopic, but long-term causing them to be anemic. And particularly with any bowel changes, that probably needs to be ruled out. It's that important. This is number two or three in the number of cancers in the country right now. So it's worth having something done if you have those kind of symptoms, and you should be screened anyway at that age.
anemia is not something that you should have. And, you know, if you are beyond that screening age or at that screening age, or and even if you are below it, you know, but you have this chronic anemia, as you mentioned, that can occur without seeing bright red bleeding or black and tarry stools that you often hear about. And if your workup is not revealing anything else, then I'm a big believer that you should have that the colon evaluated to rule out any other sores.
We had a call earlier about cost, and I think it behooves me anyway to make sure that I ask about coverage of costs by Medicare or insurance companies. What's your experience about getting colonoscopies covered in the facilities that you're working in? Is this something that's unusual? People have to go out, or most commonly it's covered?
The colonoscopies have been an issue with insurance companies and coverage at times. A person coming in with absolutely no symptoms for a screening colonoscopy, it would depend on their insurance plan whether it would be covered or not. Okay. One of the challenges we have is if we do a screening colonoscopy for a patient with no symptoms whatsoever and we find a polyp,
right,
it then changes to a diagnostic colonoscopy, which may right. change what the patient's insurance plan covers. Mm-hmm. So to give a blanket statement saying, will right. your insurance plan cover this? I won't know until halfway through the colonoscopy right. whether, right. you know, those variables may change. And so I think it's important for patients, and we encourage this, for them to call their insurance company and find out exactly what their benefits are, if it's just a screening normal exam, and what the benefits would be if there is something that's found that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, this is some of the catch-22, as I understand it, of our the way we practice medicine and how it's paid for in this country. So although preventative health care needs to be covered now under most, but not all, just a few grandfather policies, so a screening colonoscopy, which is being done at the appropriate age and everything, should be covered. But then if something's found, that may lead to different deductibles and so forth. So it gets kind of, you got to be sure about what's going on, regardless of where you get it done.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes.
All right.
And I think the best thing the patient can do is just be aware of what your policy actually covers so there are no surprises. Because that's the worst situation, is when you think you have a screening colonoscopy, suddenly you have 10 polyps, and we're going to take those polyps out, but that may change what your plan is covering.
So we're needing less, we're having less complications, we're having less colostomies being needed, we're able to do more and more sophisticated surgeon with people who are doing the same surgeries over and over with at least a better outcomes. What are the technological advances that have improved these outcomes?
I think for a colon and rectal cancer standpoint, there's been the concept of what's called total mesorectal excision, and it's basically a philosophy in how the dissection's done, where you're working along avascular planes, meaning planes that are clear body planes without excessive bleeding, and where you are taking out not only the blood vessels but the lymph nodes that are involved with the cancer. And the colon cancer, that's the primary means of spread throughout the body, is through those lymph nodes. And so it's the technique of the dissection which is important. And then also, we talked a little bit earlier about some of the technologies or advances within colorectal surgery. I think those have also benefited for low in the pelvis. You know, some of those advances that, you know, a lot of times patients may not be aware of, or as we focused a little bit earlier on laparoscopic surgery, there's the advent of robotic surgery now, and then also single-site surgeries that can be offered as well. So those are some of the technologies, but I think in terms of improving the outcomes, that really is comes down to technique and of the surgery.
And I think we also have one thing Dan didn't mention. We have modalities where we can do surgery through the anal area that can be minimally invasive. So for a lower stage cancer, we potentially could remove that through the anus. There would be no incisions on the outside of the body, and get very good results for the patient, as well as treating the cancer in the least invasive way possible.
Surgeons on this program often talk about, or patients have read about, robotics. What is it? What is it about robotics that allows a surgeon to do surgery with less complications?
So for robotic surgery, there are a few advancements that really kind of make things better for the patient and better for the surgeon. The way that the instruments are placed through the abdominal wall, the companies that have come up with robotic technologies have minimized the amount of tissue trauma right locally where the incisions are. So patients have a lot less pain to start with. We also have the ability to see things in 3D, which we have not really had great 3D visualization in the past. And seeing things that you previously just weren't able to see, it makes a huge difference in our ability to do dissections that are much more complex than we used to be able to do. And the final thing, I think, is that the instruments, we've done laparoscopic surgery for 15 years and have gotten quite facile at it, but the robotic approach gives us the ability to use what are called wristed instruments. So the instruments have many more degrees of freedom of movement than they previously did with laparoscopic surgery, and that just gives us the ability to more easily and more cleanly dissect in certain planes. So I think those are the three primary things in my mind that have made robotic surgery a significant improvement, even over laparoscopic surgery.
Okie doke. Kim, you're on line one.
Hi. Just a quick question. About 5 years ago, I ended up in the emergency room with a ruptured colon due to undiagnosed diverticulitis. I think that's the active term for it.
Sounds good.
a large portion of my colon was removed. I had a temporary colostomy and was able to do a reconnect. What are the chances of the Is there a chance that more diverticuli will form in the future? And then how does that increase any chances of cancer?
Yep, good question.
Sure. So there is, you know, the risk of recurrence is there. One of the leading theories is for recurrence is, you know, not taking that dissection or the resection of the colon low enough to what's called the rectum, and that's about the bottom 15 centimeters from the anus up to the colon, and so so there is risk of recurrence there. What we tell patients after a surgery in terms of prevention, things that you can do to prevent those diverticuli from propagating or becoming worse or having future attacks is eating a healthy diet, so high in fruit and vegetables and high fiber. I recommend all my patients to take at least a daily fiber supplement, and it's also recommended at this time, at least by the government, to take about 30 to 35 grams of soluble fiber in your diet a day. So those are the things that we know for prevention. Why is that? I think it's because by taking the fiber, you're bulking the stool, and it helps to keep it soft but firm, and that generates less pressure across those weak spots in the colon. And, that's basically what those diverticuli are, little weak spots in the wall of the colon.
There is no increased risk with diverticuli and colon cancer, but we would still recommend screening just like everyone else, starting at age 50. I'm not sure what your age is, Kim, and just continue based on the recommendations of the provider that's doing those screenings for you.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
An email came in that asked about fiber supplements, but then one of the things you did not address is what about the risk of dependence on fiber supplements?
There is really no risk of dependence. I think it's important when patients go and buy a fiber supplement that they make sure there is not a laxative component to that fiber supplement. When you go to the store, there's a whole bunch of different products, and it's really important to look at those carefully and make sure that you're getting a fiber supplement that is just fiber. If you have any questions, just take it to the pharmacist and just ask them if it is just a fiber supplement. But there is really no risk. Fiber is something that's naturally occurring in our diet. If we had a more plant-based diet, we would probably less likely need fiber supplements. But unfortunately, the American diet has become pretty high in processed food. So if you eat a very high, whole foods diet with lots of fruits and vegetables, and you're getting your 30 grams of fiber a day, you may not need a supplement. But the risk of dependence on those is really not an issue.
And that I just like, there's a difference between fiber and stool softeners. And I think that's something patients should be aware of. And so if they do have any question or need some clarification on that, as Carrie mentioned, they can talk to a pharmacist about that.
All right. So to get back to this issue of making decisions about surgery, I heard a discussion on a podcast. I'm always listening to podcasts, trying to figure out what are good questions and who are good people to interview. And this was a neurosurgeon that's very prominent in England, and he was asked by a reporter, probably, you know, how he feels, what he has to think about, what are his worries about the neurosurgery he's about to do. Does he worry about making a mistake? Does he worry about the results of mistakes he may make and so forth? And the neurosurgeon said, that's not what I worry about. What I worry about is whether I should do the surgery at all. What's he mean?
And I've heard that many times from many of my mentors. The hardest decision is to know when to operate.
Right.
The surgery itself is pretty standard. We've done it over and over. But it's tailoring your decision for surgery with the correct patient. So we may have situations where we just don't know what the benefit will be. And our job is to just be upfront with the patients and explain to them, you know, this is one option that we have. We can't be 100% certain what your particular outcome will be. We think it will be a good outcome, but we have to make that decision together with the patient. And we give them the risks and the benefits, and we help them to make that decision. I think that there are times when I think that one of the issues is end of life. You know, if we have an elderly patient who has a cancer, are they best served with us doing a surgery? Are there other methods we can use to treat that cancer with a minimally invasive approach so that they can have a good quality of life going forward?
That was somewhat what the surgeon was talking about. To put a more understanding face to it, he made the example of someone who clearly is not going to benefit from this neurosurgery because of cancer, let's say. And yet the family is insistent that the surgery go on because they feel most likely that this will be beneficial, even though the surgeon does not. So you guys, as surgeons and physicians who are not surgeons, get caught into situations where you're feeling the push to help somebody, yet your gut says this is not the right thing to do. How do you address these things?
Yeah, I think that is best handled with a team approach.
Yep.
So, you know, where you're sitting down with the family, sometimes an ethics counselor, the medical physicians as well, who may be taking care of the patient, but having a team approach to developing a plan for the patient's care. And, you know, I think it's very important to have an open, honest dialogue, not only with the patient, but also with the family. And, you know, I think this concept goes back to the point of just because you can, let's say, cut or use a scalpel doesn't mean that you always should. And I think that through clear and honest communication, that is the best way to deal with those situations or circumstances.
I would guess also that the technology we have today, our ability to look inside the body with MRI scans and various and sundry things, and even laparoscopy, which is relatively non-invasive compared to other ways we used to have, does somewhat make these decisions a little bit easier, or am I wrong?
I think using radiographic imaging and, in certain cases, things like laparoscopy really gives us a lot of information we can plan beforehand. And I think what that does for me is, you know, I could do the surgery, make an incision, go find what we need to do. But what I think it helps when we have the information beforehand is we can have a conversation with the patient about what the best expectation is for that patient or what they can expect after the surgery. And having that information before the procedure helps us to kind of talk through things with the patient, explain what the outcome is likely to be. And I think it helps with our ability to communicate with the patient what the likely outcome will be.
I'm going to give our phone number again very quickly. We only have about 5 minutes. Our local number, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. If you're sitting on your hands wondering if you should call or write, do it quickly, and we'll try to get your question answered. Let me ask a somewhat crass kind of question. What does a cancer of the colon look like at surgery? What do things look like? What's different about that tissue?
So I think what you have to understand is it looks a little differently from when you're doing a colonoscopy to when we're actually operating. So when you see it from the colonoscopy, you're actually seeing it from the inside of the colon. And that
and
usually
the colon's really to the outside. I mean, it's
exactly.
Like, I mean,
so that,
we don't think about it, but air runs right down the middle of us.
Right.
So
when you're looking through the colon with a colonoscope, you actually can see the tumor, the growth, where it's invading through the wall, and it's a kind of a infiltrating type of lesion that's growing there, and it sticks out from the wall, and it's pretty obvious a lot of times. When you're looking at it at the time of surgery, we're actually inside the abdomen, so we don't actually see the colon from the inside. We see the outside. But on the outside, it can range from not being able to see it at all to sometimes where we actually rely on tattoos that have been placed, like it's like ink that's been put into the wall to help us to see it. Sometimes it can look as simple as a little indentation in the colon wall. But there are times with more advanced cancers to where we can actually see it growing through the wall and invading other structures.
You all corrected me at the beginning of the program when I confused anal cancer with colorectal cancer. Could you explain the differences in these disorders?
So really the difference, anal cancer is primarily usually a squamous cell carcinoma, which is the type of cell that the cancer originates from. Those can be associated with a viral infection that people commonly can have, and the HPV virus can be a precursor for having the squamous cell carcinoma. Not everyone that has an HPV infection will develop anal cancer. Rectal cancer is a little bit higher up on the inside, and that's more of an adenocarcinoma. Again, that's the type of cell that cancer develops from, and most colon and rectal cancers are adenocarcinomas. The treatment for rectal cancer and the treatment for anal cancer are different, where one of the primary means for treatment of rectal cancer is surgery, and one of the more primary means of squamous cell carcinoma treatment for anal cancer is just chemotherapy and radiation with minimization of surgery. So they are treated very differently, and we believe there are different causes, but all of that has not yet been fully researched.
I think I would be remiss not to bring up the issue of we have a vaccine that protects against a high percentage of the known oncogenic or cancer-producing HPV viruses now. There seems to be, as always, some resistance from some people to these vaccines, but it is absolutely a proven very, very safe vaccine and probably one of our most important vaccines now. So that cervical cancer, anal cancer, some head and neck cancers seem to be highly related to infection with these. I'm choosing my words carefully. We know cervical cancer is caused by particularly number 16, number 18 of the HPV vaccines. And I'm not sure that's necessarily true of anal cancer. Maybe you guys know the same ones?
Yeah,
same.
16 and 18 are the same.
And there are some other ones. It is not true, as Dr. Bossert said, that just because you get the infection, you're gonna get the cancer, but of those people who have the cancer, almost all of them have been infected by those types, and that can be prevented with the vaccine before exposure. Okay. All right, we're coming down to our just last couple of minutes, and I've gotten in the habit of asking my guests to just make a couple of comments of the things they want to make sure people come away from trying to remember. What's the most important points today we want people to remember?
I think the most important point for me is to get your screening. A lot of patients express that they are fearful of having a colonoscopy. They've heard about friends or family that have had not as good of an experience, but it's a very important test, and I think it's important to talk with the provider that will be doing your test about what the expectation is, what you should feel, what you should be going through, and make sure you ask questions along the way. But I think it's a relatively simple test, and I think it's very important to people to get their screening colonoscopies done.
Yeah, prevention. I think that is the key, if I could stress that to patients. And also to let you know that you're not alone out there. There are tons of people with issues of the colon, the rectum, and anus, and there are people that and treatments to help you with that.
All right. I want to say my thanks to Dr. Carrie Bossert and Dr. Dan Rossi for taking the time today. We very much appreciate it. If you have questions or comments, you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org as well. Next week, we're going to return, and Pennis Pemberton's going to be the host then, and he's talking about the hijacked mind. He's really going to be discussing addiction. So take a listen next Monday at 2 p.m. Let me remind you that Pat Yak is our chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Gokey is our audio engineer today and is always our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.